All right, just by way of information, I've been trying to figure out how to get the PowerPoints kind of included with everything, and finally we got past my technological slowness so that I'm being able to include it now that if you go out to the Facebook page, Monday Morning Institute class, where I upload the podcast of this class, right above it, I'm being able to include the link to the PowerPoint.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay, so it'll be right along the top, new class and everything, and as a link to PowerPoint, you can just click on that, and you should be able to get what we're doing there. Because oftentimes I've gathered a lot of other information that we may or may not get to along the way, but I will try, if I get some extra time over the holidays, I may back link to all the other classes, but at least starting last week, and then certainly with today, when Dee gets me the recording, we upload it. We'll put a link to the PowerPoint.
It's
a Monday Morning Institute class.
Is it Institute or Religion class, Kevin? Is it Institute?
It's Monday Morning Religion class. Thank you. Don't mind me. Don't look at all
we'll
of
always just listen to your wife.
I know. Monday morning religion class. Okay.
Now we know why he keeps you around.
That's exactly. Oh, you don't know the half of it. And we have a new apostle. Elder Clouseau. Oh, no, Clouseau.
Clouseau, yeah. He is. His wife is the sister of the mission president that Cindy and I served under.
Oh, is that right? That's awesome.
And they're wonderful people.
That sounds good. All right. Well, that said, like I say, this is a fun class. I don't always know as I'm gathering information kind of what the theme will be, and this one really kind of jumped out at me when I started taking a look at that. So. Let me start with this. This is just kind of some pictures from Europe. What's happening, we know that in Europe, as it is happening here, it's a little faster there, and it's coming here, and that is that churches are closing all over the place. That they are losing membership, and as they do, these beautiful churches are falling into disrepair. Because the rising generation doesn't have the same faith as their family did, okay? As their parents did, as their grandparents did, and so
Wait,
the.
Are you talking about historically or currently?
Currently.
Okay.
Yeah, currently. These are current pictures. It's like all these old churches that they built, and nobody's in these villages and stuff. Nobody's going to church anymore, and Europe is becoming incredibly secular.
As opposed to us who don't build churches and are building stadiums.
That's right. It's true.
Those are our churches.
Yeah. So that's the problem. And so they've been trying to figure out for the longest time of how do we interest the rising generation in the church, in our churches that we believe. Well, we have the same deal, don't we? The brethren have said over and over that this church, no matter how vibrant it might be, we're always a generation or two away from extinction. We always are, because if those can go away, then by the time we get to the next generation, it's gone. And certainly we've seen population shifts among that, but on top of that, isn't that always our biggest question anyway? How do we get the gospel into the hearts and minds of our kids and grandkids? How do we do it? Now, as it turns out, I was thinking about this, that in my, you're going to wonder where I'm going with this. In my digital world, all of my digital devices all come from a certain company named after a fruit. Okay? And whether it's whether it's my computer, or whether it's my laptop, whether it's my iPad, whether it's my watch, whether it is...
your Apple Channel 4 TV.
Yeah, my TV thing. Yeah, everything. Everything is on the same and same wavelength, okay? And one of the reasons why I do that is that not only do I like the way the thing works, but also if I load something onto my laptop, it shows up on my computer. I put something on my computer, you know, within like 2 or 3 minutes, 2 or 3 seconds, it's on my iPad. And if I put something on here, it ends up on my watch. You know? It's just everything talks to each other. Now, from time to time, it's interesting that if somehow I'm being hacked on this whole thing, then I'm going to see this thing as it's like, oh, we need to do an update. So there will be an update come along, and it'll say we're fixing errors. We're putting another fix in to give it greater security or to update more information and more knowledge. And it happens then on my computer, and then a second later, it's on my laptop and everything else, and it just automatically does that. And it's just kind of a very cool thing, right? Now, what would happen, for those of you who might be working out of the same fruity company, if suddenly in a fire, my laptop and my computer and my iPad and my phone and my watch and my tracking devices and my earphones were all consumed in a fire, would that data be lost?
Nope.
No, where do I go?
Cloud.
The cloud. It's on the cloud. Okay, so like if I change out my phone, I'm going to go in there, they'll deconnect this phone, and we will connect my phone to the iCloud, and it downloads all the information. It's such an amazing thing. And it's all accurate across the board. Now, wouldn't it be interesting if we could do that with a kid? You have knowledge, and wouldn't it be nice to download that information to them, and they're going to get it right?
Well, be careful about all this connectivity, because I was talking to a friend just a few days ago that had made a visit to China. And he said, when I got over there, they knew that I had a U.S. security clearance.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So there's the downside of...
I didn't tell them. And I don't think the U.S. government told them, but they knew it.
But somehow they knew it, yeah. And we're going to see the downside of that. And so, again, wouldn't it be nice, though, if we could download what we know?
So the problem is when you load something up on your laptop, it ends up on your computer.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So the things that my son, my oldest son, has uploaded, I don't want in my cloud. So there's you can't have it.
There is going to be some problems with the way that we do this. Now, by the way, would there be some problems if it's like, I have a testimony, and I'm going to download it to my kids, and they're going to get it pure and clean, and they're going to understand it exactly the way that I understand it?
You mean they're going to misunderstand it exactly the way they
You think there might be a misunderstanding?
Misunderstanding.
But isn't that what we're wanting? Are we wanting to have the faith of our fathers that I picked up, and then I want you to love the gospel the same way that I love the gospel?
We want them to have their own faith that is comparable to ours.
Comparable, I think, would be better than the same.
Do you want it comparable, or do you want it as good as yours?
No,
do you
I
want, you want it exactly like yours?
Well, I don't want it exactly. I just want it.
Mine has flaws. I want this to be
well,
better than mine.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. Better than mine.
You don't want to ignore the fact that if we want them to be like us, they got to be willing to do what we did. And if they don't have that opportunity, it's not going to work.
And that's true. That's reality. But that, again, that's not what we want. Because the problem is, if we don't download it right directly to them, they might get it wrong. Or maybe they won't love it the same way that I love it. Or maybe they won't have the same fervor. Or maybe they won't...
Are we certain that we got it right?
Yes. Well, of course I got it right.
There's a mantra we use a lot in therapy that says people value what they discover more than what they're told. And I think that's what it boils down to. I want my children to have well-informed, well-examined faith that they've architected. And that way they will value it more.
But isn't how often, because the chance might be that they might get it wrong, as parents, especially in our culture, we oftentimes we're not willing to risk that. We don't want them to necessarily, because they might get it wrong. So I've got to make sure that I say it and drill it, and I'm going to make sure. For instance, I get, it's one of those little things, pet peeves in my office, I get that kids and devices need to be protected from social media and from and make sure they're not going to the wrong websites. But then I lock it down so tightly that they never get a chance to have that experience of how are they going to make decisions until we send them off to school, when automatically they're going to be able to make their own choices, even though they've never had their ability to have their own choices. And they've never learned and they've never grown, but we're so worried about what they may find that we take away that ability for them to grow and learn.
Well, trial and error.
And that, yeah, we don't want that, yeah.
Well, children don't necessarily learn just by what we say to them.
But they should. I told them because I lectured them, right? I told them. They know this.
But then there's that gap from what we do, from what we've said, and then from what we may preach.
Yeah.
And, I mean, how do you deal with that gap between those things and avoid
where there's a risk factor that they might be,
they don't trust what we say because that's not what we do.
And that's the part that freaks us out. What happens in that gap where they're trying to learn this and we got to make sure they learn it right?
I just have an anecdotal story. My son, COVID. And it's COVID's fault.
Oh, COVID was crazy.
It ruined some serious opportunities that might have been different. And I just figured the Lord has to take responsibility for that one. But my dad came to me and said, "What is he doing with that phone? You need to take that phone."
Yes.
And I thought.
That's right.
And I said, "But how is he going to learn the phone?" Because I wanted my children, I made them take AP classes. I knew they weren't going to get the good grades that would, but I wanted them to fail with me as their backup, so they knew how to handle it. So I can see both sides. I can see helping them to teach them to regulate at the same time. So the line we walk.
But if they're regulating, there's a risk that they might fail, and we don't want them to fail.
Well, no, they're not failing. They're just off-roading. The wheels haven't come off yet.
Oh, there's a lot of off-roading these days.
The wheels haven't come off yet.
Yeah, so allergies. The World Health Organization gives a mixture of powdered milk and peanut butter to millions and millions of children, and they are on the record as saying that they've never encountered a single case of peanut allergy. Okay, and we have all these people in the United States who have peanut allergy. I don't know whether the WHO is somewhat a little bit fudging the numbers, but a lot of our peanut allergy is because the kids are not allowed to be exposed to peanuts. And we had this thing in the 1950s and 60s where everything was sanitized all the time, and the kids never were exposed to germs to the extent, and then when they were exposed to a little bit, they got sick because really fast.
This is the Purell generation.
And so we have that now with, you know, some people are going purely stay away from everything, and other people are going, let's get vaccinated for everything. And it's a controversial thing, but everybody isn't right. And in fact, none of them are right all the time.
That's true. Okay, so you got a sense of it? Okay, so now let's take this. Okay, so here's the question then. And that is, how do we update, how do we, you know, vaccinate or not, how do we update this rising generation? And there has always been a difference across the spectrum about how we're going to do this. And you're going to really see it when we get to the 1930s. That's why I say you're going to love, kind of, because they're struggling with the same kind of things. Okay, now you need to understand though that in order to know which way you go, we talked a month or two ago about contraries in the church. And there's always going to be faith versus works or mercy versus justice or something like that. Well, when we get to these questions, there are always eternal contraries. So let me give you, for instance, when I was in graduate school, and I don't know if you've got the same thing, but in taking testing classes, one of the things that they learn is if you really want to understand where somebody is, you give them what's called a forced choice questionnaire. And the forced choice is that you're going to have to choose between two goods, which means I'm going to choose one, which means I'm not choosing the other. So let me give you an example of that. Let's see. I think did an update. Dang it. Okay.
Go to the cloud.
I know. I'm waiting on the cloud to figure this out. Let me give you an example. Do you want, if I'm going to give you a question, do you want from your kids, do you want to be loved or do you want to be respected? And automatically we always go, both. I want both. Yes, but you have to choose one of the two.
What?
If I'm going to choose respect, then I'm going to have a little less love, or I'm going to have a little less love so that I can get more respect.
But is love earned?
That's another question.
Because if your kids have the right characteristics, they're going to love you, whether even if
see,
they don't like you.
See, you're wanting to mix those two.
No, I'm just saying that you go for respect because they're going to love you anyway, unless they're bad.
Yeah,
but you've only got a box to check. He can't.
That's right. That's right. You don't get to do that thing. You go, yeah, but I want to write in between. How do I do that? Okay. Do you want love or do you want respect? Now, the other principle that goes with that, though, because you're going to choose one. I think I want to be more loved than respected. No, I want to be more respected than I want to be loved. But I want both. Now, the other thing is, though, that goes with contraries is any virtue that we have taken too far becomes a vice. So what if you choose, I'm going to check the box for being loved. And I want to be... But now I want to be like completely loved. If I take that all the way to the extreme, what do I end up with? Kind of people pleasing, all of those kind of things. So I've gone so far on that love side that I just want to be liked and loved all the time, and I'm not going to do anything where they might not like me. Okay? No, so I checked the respect side. Now if I go all the way to the extreme on respect, what do I get?
Fear. Drill instructor.
Fear, yes. Now, it's about fear. You're not going to love me, but I want you to you're going to respect me. No, we're afraid of you. If we go so far away from the love pole into the respect thing, so that's why trying to balance between the two here, guys, is always going to be incredibly hard. And in a gospel principle, especially if we're trying to figure out what do we instill in kids, well, here's the battle. So here's some of those. How about if we're trying to balance between the true church, I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that this church is true with every fiber of my being, and I know that Bruce is the McConkie. No. Okay? With all that tradition versus, no, this is a living church and things change. You go, well, I believe that there will be new revelation. Well, is that going to change what I used to believe over here? And now you're going to lean. By the way, you're going to lean one way or the other on all of these. You want to pretend you don't, but you do. Because the problem is, if I lean into tradition, I'm leaning away from new revelation or changes. And if I'm leaning into changes, I'm leaning away from tradition. And we don't want that. But the struggle that we have, the eternal tension that we have in the gospel is between two poles. Okay, does that make sense? So let me give you a few more. Does obedience produce faith, or does faith result in obedience? Which comes first? If I have faith, do I obey? Or if I obey enough, do I develop faith? And you go, well, do I have to choose? Yeah, I want to say both. But the problem is that when it comes to what we're actually, when we actually are teaching somebody or working with somebody, we're going to lean one way or the other, and we're going to be uncomfortable that we're leaning away from the other one.
I'm not. I'm good on both of the second answers.
Okay, you're saying, because what we struggle with is how do I have both?
Well, we live in a culture, okay? And so as long as our culture is going to change, then we can't lock in on tradition.
You're leaning this way.
Yeah, but I'm not changing for the sake of change. I'm only changing when there's a reason to change.
But you're still changing.
Yes.
Okay. And I
never saw obedience producing faith. I've never seen obedience.
Well, I haven't either, but depending on how we do it, yeah.
Well, me being a new convert, I would go with the obedience first, because I know when I first started visiting with the missionaries and stuff, and they were like, okay, well, you got to give up coffee, you got to give up tea,
yeah,
which is something that I've always had on most of my life.
And they say, well, just trust us.
So I'm having to obey first so that I can...
I hear you.
But you couldn't have obeyed if you didn't have enough faith to obey.
but you'll find in parenting approaches, you'll find that parents pull one way or the other. Again, and it's still lightened up by, I need you to respect me and not love me. I'm going to tell you what you can't do. Okay, so let me give you another one. How about the what's written in the scriptures versus your personal inspiration? Because hold on to this, because this was one of those things that started coming up in the 30s when they were trying to say, is Job a real person? It's in the Bible, you know, or is it an allegory? You know, and they go, whoa. Depending on where they were, they would flip back and forth. Okay? I'll give you another one. You're gonna read the scriptures to do it devotionally so that I feel the Spirit? Or are you gonna read the scriptures to try and understand the authorship of Matthew versus John? Or I'm gonna look at it and say, maybe that's not exactly what Paul meant.
Or what he said, actually.
Or what he said, yeah. Did he really say, maybe Paul
Nobody
wasn't really the author.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, somebody, it went through for their filters if Paul didn't write it himself.
Yeah, then who's doing it and for what purpose? Not, that's critical writing. By the way, in critical sense, do you know that just this week that they announced a study that a BYU professor found another woman in the New Testament?
Yeah.
Is that cool? Do you see that? Uh-huh. Because we've always talked about from the disciple, I guess it was John, the book of John, or one of the books of John, that we're the disciple to the what?
The elect lady.
And it turns out they've been translating that wrong all along. And now it says the disciple to Electa. Uh-huh. Her name was Electa. And we have always thought elect lady. So what does elect mean? Maybe it's the church. Maybe it was Mary. I don't know. You know, it could be Emma Smith. Who's the elect lady? And you got, no, her name was Electa. she was a powerful person in her branch in her home church. Okay? Whoops. And this has been authenticated to the point that it's going back to the Greek, that there's a society that takes all the new Greek manuscripts every year, and they update it, and then when people are doing new translations from the Greek, they go to this Greek society, and it says, based on all the manuscripts we get, this is now the best information we have. It's gone to that level where all the new Testaments now going forward, they're going to come from that translation, are going to say the disciple to Electa, not to the elect lady. Okay. Well, that's critical study. That's digging in. Okay. I don't care about Electa. I just want to know if I feel the Spirit because I'm having a hard day and I'm just reading the Bible. Okay. Well, there's that desire to be loved person. Oh, I put it out of order. Learn to trust. Learn to question. In the 70s, if I'd said to you in the 70s, Dad, I'm not sure whether there will be polygamy in heaven. In the 70s, what would have been the answer?
Of course there is.
Okay. Or what else might we hear?
I'd tell you, it'll be whatever should be done. God's going to do it right.
That's right. Well, and say, it's not important to your salvation.
That's it.
It's not important to your salvation whether the gates at heaven creak to the right or to the left. Don't ask. It'll be open.
Just go to a high priest group meeting.
Oh my God.
Maybe that's where we just banned
it. Oh my God. What does it mean to be, let's tear this thing apart. And at the end of that, somebody would say, it's not important to your salvation, but we're interested.
Or they'll name drop a general authority, so.
Yes, that's right. Did you listen to that talk on the seven heresies? Well, that's the Mormon doctrine said, okay, the thinking has been done. Stop thinking. Stop asking. And that was, we're going to, so we want you to not question. Okay?
But that happens in our gospel doctrine classes all the time. If somebody raises a question, like a new member, and they say something that they don't quite understand yet, or they question, and then the well-meaning person stands up and says, "Well, I have a testimony."
Yes.
Da da da. That stops all community.
And the thinking is now supposed to stop because the answer has been given.
Then you get the wrong teacher if that stops.
That's true, but they're out there.
Yeah, but.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say questions are important because that's how we learn.
Well, that's because there is a tendency, especially we were talking about seminary earlier, talking about how kids think these days. They're being told to question. Ask questions. Doubts are okay. All right, are we ready to do that one?
As seminary teachers, we were counseled to never use that answer.
Oh, good.
You're better off, I don't know.
Yeah, you really are. But that's where, in other words, what are we teaching? How are we teaching it, this thing? How about this one? I like this one.
Yeah.
Institutional authority versus personal inspiration. My bishop said, I remember very, very clearly, I remember this moment that every Sunday night, living in Utah, we would drive into Salt Lake to see the folks. Every Sunday night, we're going to visit my mother's parents and my father's parents. We're going to go see the folks. So we would sit in the car, and we'd drive from Layton to Salt Lake to go see the folks. And then we would drive home from seeing the folks, and we would talk, okay? And I remember sitting between my mom and my dad, and my mom said to my dad, so your dad and his new wife, and the bishop wants him to serve a mission. And I was the other way around. My dad said that they want to serve a mission. And my mom says, they can't do that. She's getting dementia. She's not able to function. Maybe the bishop is wrong. And I very clearly remember my dad saying, don't talk about that in front of the kids.
Yeah, because you were so impressionable.
Yeah, we don't talk about the fact that the bishop might be wrong. We'll talk about it when we get home.
Y'all were not raised in the same house as
Yeah.
we,
no, but this was,
we talked
you
about
know,
that?
For in my household, this was a never watch TV on Sunday kind of thing on Sunday.
And yet in the church, we have institutional stamped all over us.
Oh.
To the point that we have the same pictures hanging in our halls.
Yeah.
We use the same vacuum cleaners. The
same furniture.
The
yeah, I know.
And it just, that's that lack of individuality is, frankly, as a convert to the church, probably has bothered me more than most people. But it has disturbed me.
Yeah, I know. But and this is where institutionally we're still a bit top down.
A
And we have this rising generation that's saying, we don't like, we need to be able to have our own, which means I may have, I may disagree with what an apostle says at General Conference. Boom, boom, boom. You know, it's like there's a problem with that.
Problem with you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yes, it's your personal.
Okay, so this is the first time in history this has ever been a struggle, right? Oh, contraire. Let me give you some history here. That's what I found interesting. After statehood, 1896, the church has had a series of academies of higher education, which was really kind of just junior colleges. So we had academies where?
Provo,
the Brigham Young Academy. We had
Salt Lake City.
Salt Lake Deseret Academy.
Didn't we have Rexburg
then? We had Rexburg Academy, where my great-grandfather taught. We had one in Gila, Arizona.
Gila.
Okay.
Logan.
We had one, I think, a couple of others. Anyway. Oh, there was one in Ephraim.
Was there Dixie then?
And Dixie was another one.
Logan.
And Logan had one. So they had all of these church academies, church-sponsored, where kind of the gospel was being taught along with secular topics. Well, what happens is with statehood, they transfer them to the states, and the church gets out of the junior college business the same way that they did with the hospital system.
Yeah. I remember in reading a biography of Brigham Young that he did not believe in public education.
No, he didn't.
And then you should pay for it.
In the state of Deseret, that we're going to have all of these church, because again, do we want a secular education or religious education? Do we want to be in the world or we want to be in the truth? the way that this was dichotomized, right? So what happens is the church is in the process of transferring these academies. So how do these kids then learn the gospel? Well, Joseph Merrill, who was the what was then the Commissioner of Education, begins this establishment of seminaries and institutes that's then going to require professional teachers. We're going to have these guys that are going to be teaching, and there was always a battle in Utah about having release time, where kids are going to walk across the street from the high school, like I did growing up, and go to a seminary class for an hour. But you could only get credit for New Testament and Old Testament. You weren't going to get credit for Book of Mormon as far as high school graduation is concerned.
See, we didn't get any credit for it at all. It was just release time.
Yeah.
That was Arizona.
Oh, okay,
And the same battle, I mean.
It was.
Yeah, you walked across the street and went
to. Yeah, in Utah we were still getting, so we could, you'd get high school credit for those biblical classes. Mm-hmm. But Arizona, Idaho, mm-hmm. not so much, right? And you guys, some of you guys remember that. With professional teachers, most of these teachers that were being hired by the church to teach seminary or institute didn't even have high school diplomas. In some cases, the seminary instruction was like going to a ball game or playing games. They just really had no idea. They had no formal training. Didn't know what they were doing. They were getting about $2,000 a month from the church. They're professional teachers. Okay? And then it really got bad during the Depression, the price cuts, wage cuts. But they had these professional teachers. So how do you train these guys a little bit was part of the question. And it got to the point, though, in 1911, there's the scandal at BYU in 1911, that they had teachers, professional teachers at BYU, teaching evolution. And they were also teaching higher biblical criticism.
What's that?
That means, did Isaiah really write all of the chapters of Isaiah? Or maybe Deutero-Isaiah, the last third of it? Maybe that was written by somebody else because he's talking about things that weren't contemporary. Who was the real author of Matthew? You know, everything we were just talking about, this higher biblical criticism. And then we were starting to get what we're going to talk about in about a month, the Q gospel coming out of Germany, talking about the fact that, well, maybe Jesus didn't really do any miracles. Maybe it was just an ethical teacher. He was a good rabbi, okay, and there were no miracles, okay? So they're starting to teach it. Anyway, there's a famous firing of three teachers. They're let go by the church because they're teaching these horrible things. But you can see there's a creeping modernism, they called it, into it. And at the same time, they had incredible scholars like B.H. Roberts and John A. Witzel were continuing to demonstrate that they could balance their faith and the most current gospel or the biblical scholarship. Okay, so there is this push going back and forth. What do we, what do we want our teachers to teach?
Isn't well, about the same time as the, just a few years later was the Scopes monkey trial.
Was right concurrent with this. The Scopes monkey trial was right. Yes.
And was B.H. Roberts balancing it in the classroom, but not otherwise?
Yeah, he was. But in his writings, remember, as we talked about last time, all the writings that he's doing is he's coming up with anachronisms in the Book of Mormon and stuff. He's doing Book of Mormon critical writing and then sending it into the church, and the church is going, got their hairs on fire.
But he didn't do that in his classroom.
No. He knew what, he was learning how to balance it pretty well and not speak in certain settings. Although he would certainly have private conversations, somebody go and talk to him, he'd tell their opinion.
Don't bite the hand that feeds you.
Yes, he's smart on that. Okay, so here's the history, and this is from BYU professor who's done the historical research on this. Anyway, he says, Sidney Sperry, a young seminary teacher, left on his own initiative to attend the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, 1925. Sperry received his master's degree from the Divinity School in 26, specializing in Old Testament studies. And it's around the same time that another teacher, Heber Snell, goes to the Pacific School of Religion and majors in Biblical Studies. So you got guys that don't even have their high school degrees, and suddenly you've got these rising scholars that are going off outside of Utah and catching up on the most current understanding of biblical studies and then coming back and teaching it. In 1928, Snell was invited to lecture at Aspen Grove. So here's what happened. Everybody been to Aspen Grove up near Sundance? Okay. What would happen is they would take all of these seminary teachers and institute and BYU professors, and they would camp out for a week at Aspen Grove every August. Okay. And you'd bring your family and attend. And then they would have teachers come in, like B.H. Roberts, to come and lecture to them. That's their way of trying to give them more knowledge and understanding. Joseph Merrill was really organizing this. And then they would sit around the campfires at night, and they would talk about what they were learning. Okay, so that was the Aspen Grove thing. And there's a certain amount of that they still do. So Snell, in 1928, he teaches two courses to these guys, Historical Development of Religion, the Beginnings of Christianity, and the following year, Sperry was invited to teach two classes on Old Testament history and literature. And think about this a little bit like to a group of guys that were willing to work for the church and work for less. Remember, it was President McKay who said, I don't want mercenaries teaching my grandkids.
Oh, that's right. Just underpays everybody.
So underpay everybody, yeah. So they're here because they want to be. Right? So there's a great talk by him, What I Want You to Teach My Grandkids. Find that one on Google. It's fun. But anyway, so they're not making anything, but they're there. And then Snell and then Sperry dropped this stuff on him at Aspen Grove. And it's like, there is a whole world of scholarship out there we know nothing about, because we've been staying, we're inside the fortress in Utah. We had no idea this stuff was out there to the extent that it is, and it just blew their minds. So what happens then, at Merrill's suggestion, is eye-opener for Commissioner Merrill and other teachers. So Russell Swenson, one of the students there, wrote of Snell's class. I was particularly impressed by Snell's historical approach to the subject and his deep appreciation of the religious message of the Old Testament. There's depth here. This is awesome. Okay? So what they do, There's another guy, Ted Yerlian, he's going to be one of these prominent teachers. He said he felt an exhilaration that he had not experienced in any religious education. Leon felt he was entertaining a thrilling new realm of biblical scholarship involving the use of original sources, imagine that, and languages. Swenson noted Sperry's friendly personality and his ability as a teacher were most stimulating to me, as well as most other young teachers who are planning to devote their lives to church education. This is just house on fire. This, and then they sit around at night and go, could you read? And they just all got pumped up. Well, what are we going to do? Well, here's what they're going to do. So, inspired by Sperry, they're going to ask Edgar Goodspeed from Chicago, who's invited to speak at Aspen Grove the next year, 29. Okay. Goodspeed had just completed his own translation of the Bible. He was considered one of the foremost scholars in the New Testament in the United States. He's going to speak at Aspen Grove. Now, what was hair on fire from these guys is now a bonfire because he is so prominent. General authorities start dropping in on Goodspeed's classes and invite him to speak in the tabernacle. They're just, and I without saying it, I'm pretty sure I know who the general authorities were. It might be somebody who starts with BH.
Might be somebody what?
But he just electrifies. He electrifies the group. Okay?
And he is not a Mormon, right?
No, he's not. And this is going on, as we were talking about last time. The background, the forces beyond this, are, remember, the fundamentalism that's starting right at the turn of the century, that we want that everything is in the Bible, and we want fundamental understanding. And then the whole country was going through this modernist, thoroughly modern Millie. We're becoming more enlightened with the Scopes trial, with all those kind of things. People coming back from World War I with more knowledge. You know, how do you keep them on the farm after they've seen Gay Perry? That kind of stuff, right? So that's going on in the background. And so... In 1930, the next year, Joseph Merrill chooses three students and he sends them at church expense to the University of Chicago. One of them is going to be Lyons, because they want them to go out and get this knowledge and bring it back to the church system.
So what is the new information that they're talking about in the Old Testament? Is it there wasn't a real Job, or what?
That question is on the board, and Jonah, we're not sure if there was a real Jonah, but we're actually going to draw from the original sources beyond King James to look at what exactly Isaiah was talking about, and you know, and the possibility that maybe the Egyptians didn't really hold the children of Israel, that maybe that's metaphorical. I mean, they're... we're going to talk about it. This is a pretty liberal college. It's a really pretty liberal college that they're landing in. Okay?
Yes.
And the reason why is that only a liberal college, like Chicago, is going to accept Mormon students. The conservative colleges aren't going to let Mormons show up and be in their faculty. They don't believe in the Trinity. Like a lot of our preschools around here, you can't. But we're going off to Mormon. The Mormons are there.
When you're talking about original sources,
yeah,
what are you talking about?
The being able to read it in the original Greek,
okay.
Being able to read it in the original Hebrew for the Old Testament, and it may be different than what's in the King James kind of thing. So that also means, to the chagrin of J. Reuben Clark, we'll talk about in a second, that maybe there are other versions of the New Testament that might be as good or better than the King James Version. It's not the only true Bible on the face of the earth. And so they're looking at all the things that they're learning. They're also gathering newest scholarship coming as people, archaeologists are out there. Okay? So these guys are going to go out there. So here's the reports coming from Chicago. Riding home from Chicago, Swenson is full of praise. He's trying to assuage his father's concerns. Now, look, before you condemn the scholars and thinkers to think it'd be worth the price to investigate their way of thinking, they have no diabolical scheme to underline the truth, but the reverse, to discover it. You know, parents are sitting at home and it's like, oh my gosh, what are you learning in Chicago? No, that is really cool. They're trying to find the truth, not bury it. Okay? Yeah, but they're not Mormon. Yeah. Swenson gushed over the stimulus and study when sitting at the feet of brilliant professors. And I love this. The past year will be a bright spot in my life. George Tanner, another student, found himself enamored with the school. I learned more about the Bible and the things there in a semester than in a lot of our church institutions in five times the length of time. Okay? Wow, these guys really know what they're talking about. And they've got the original sources to back it up. This is so cool. You know, they're just blowing up. Okay? At the same time, the students perceived the attention you'd expect from Chicago faculty. Another letter, Swenson notes, the school has a strong group of skeptical agnostic professors, but our dean is a courageous defender of the faith as well as the expounder of the faith. Goodspeed. He is often the butt of sharp attacks from conservative Christians, fundamentalists, but there is no abler teacher of religion in the light of modern science. So some of those that are being able to say, I can hold on to my faith, and actually what I'm learning enhances my faith. That's the balance. How do you do that? Okay. To recognize when maybe it's gone too far. But anyway, so that's they're cranking that up. Okay. Now, here's the downside to that. Okay? How do you keep them on the farm after they've seen Gay Perry? Okay. Daryl Chase, assigned to teach at a high school, wrote to Swenson after he gets back from Chicago. It's next to impossible to keep from slipping backwards intellectually in such an environment. It is not that I'm overworked, but the monotony is killing. Six classes of Old Testament daily to little children who have to be told the meaning of half the words of their text. God of my fathers, why am I so cursed? I've been in Chicago at the stimulating thing, and now I'm sitting in Rexburg teaching, you know, 14-year-olds about the Old Testament, and then just they're blowing up. In a similar vein, Chase wrote to Lyon, I used to think I knew how to teach the Old Testament to high school students, but after my work at the University of Chicago, I discovered what an impossible task it was to teach the Old Testament as it actually is, and at the same time feed the religious life of young boys and girls. For that reason, I persuaded my associate teachers to relieve me of all my Old Testament duties. In other words, I have learned, and now it's hard to just go back and teach the basics and have gospel doctrine answers.
Were they experiencing pressure from their superiors to teach only the...
Yeah, and it just gets worse. Because this is going to be like 30... This is going to be like 32, 31, 32, 33. And remember that B.H. Roberts, and he's going to die in 33, but he wants to publish his book in 32. Now, in the middle of all of that, there's going to be another couple of problems. So now, 1935 study of BYU students. Some of their concerns were not necessarily unfounded, okay? Modern revelation, 25% of students at BYU did not believe that prophets received modern revelation. Here comes the modernism, right? Without the ability to balance both of those, if we're just gonna go from one extreme to another, all of those virtues become vices. Evolution, 64% of students believed in biological evolution. Which in that day meant, if I believe in evolution, I don't believe in creationism. I'm going to either believe in evolution or Genesis, but you can't believe in both. Okay, even though B.H. Roberts was working hard to say, no, there are ways to reconcile both of those. That's not what they're getting.
Thomas Edison, he it took him 10,000 tries to develop a light bulb filament.
Yeah.
I think most people who design and build things, they build a more rudimentary one before they build a better one.
And like B.H. Roberts said, and that might have been what the creation was like.
That's intelligent design.
Yeah. Okay, here's another one. How about, do you believe in the devil? Nah, 62% didn't believe in the existence of a literal devil. Okay? But this is BYU, this is our brightest. This is the kids of our general authorities that are there. Okay? Yeah, we got worse. The word of wisdom, personal conduct. Nearly half the students did not consider alcohol a sin, and 89% supported birth control. The horror. Okay? But this was a problem. Only half to two-thirds attended church weekly, paid tithing, obeyed the word of wisdom, or prayed daily. So there was a problem. It had gone from fundamentalist side to switching all the way over here. Not that we ever do, not that society doesn't like to swing back and forth. Think about our politics. We'll go from here to here, and this last week was proof that we swing back and forth.
This okay? be the what? Time of President Nelson's family who had alcohol in their basement. This would be about their time.
This would be about that time, yeah, because it just wasn't that big a deal. Especially if you're kind of now this enlightened age. In an enlightened age, when you start to move all the way to the Enlightenment stuff, then you discard any of the traditional stuff. That's the problem. Yeah. Well,
those same survey questions today, what results would they generate?
Wouldn't that be interesting? Yeah. Yeah. If they're really honest.
What's the statistical...
Of today?
Well, you do a survey, you just can't stop the first 10 that come by.
They had really digging in. They did some pretty extensive stuff, and I'll tell you why here in a second. But that was certainly the problem. And sometimes, like, I had a kid, this is showing, just last year, a kid that gone to BYU, Idaho, just in the last year or two, and most of his ward wasn't showing up to church. Church was kind of optional for them in Rexburg, in this ward, okay? And it starts to swing one way, and then it just kind of gets worse. Okay, so what is to be done about all of this? What is to be done? Oh, yes. This is what was to be done. In the middle of all of this, Heber J. Grant needs a new counselor, and he's gonna go find in 1930 J. Reuben Clark is serving as ambassador to Mexico. J. Reuben Clark had gone to Harvard or Yale, was the valedictorian of the Yale law school. He went right from there to being assistant solicitor general for the State Department, the government. Was involved in a lot of international stuff going on. And so by 1930, remember when all this stuff is stirring up, 1930 he's serving as the ambassador to Mexico. It's right about the time, by the way, that we had a branch president and one of the members shot and killed by revolutionaries in Mexico. So the church was real fine with having somebody that could help negotiate that stuff. Okay? So, and he'd also been serving concurrently in what is now the Young Men's General Board. He wasn't really all that active, to be honest, but he was one of the more brilliant minds that ever graduated from the Deseret Church School. So in 1932, he's called to the first presidency. He will have a year to put his estate right, and to finish stuff in Mexico. So he's called in 32, but it won't be April of 33 before J. Reuben Clark now takes his seat as the...
Is this George Albert Smith that calls him?
Heber J. Grant.
Heber J. Grant.
Was he an apostle before that?
No.
No.
No. I mean, we talk about our new apostle, and this, he's coming out of nowhere. But we had that. But who was the last couple of people that were called to be apostles who hadn't even been general authorities?
The presiding bishop isn't a general authority?
This is how President Oaks and President Nelson went straight into apostleship. They weren't even serving as 70s, or I think they were both regional reps.
I don't think they were bishops.
They hadn't even been bishops. Or
Nelson was president of the Sunday school.
President Oaks, yeah, was teaching gospel doctrine when he was called.
That's right. But he was also a Supreme Court justice, and everybody right. knew Russell Nelson because he'd all been their doctors. Remember President Kimball standing up in conference and saying, "This man has touched my heart deeply." But he hadn't even been anywhere near. And so he's being called right to the first presidency, not even an apostle. Now, he will be made an apostle like about that same time. But he's coming right in. Now, so he sustained in April of 33.
He was never a member of the quorum.
Never. Never. Go. So years later, he would write in his diary, just give you an idea what he felt like he walked in on. The late 30s was a time of sensitive relations between Salt Lake City and Provo. Translate that as between the Brethren and BYU. That's what that's saying. Many Brigham Young University faculty members were beginning to feel themselves qualified scholastically and spiritually to reconcile the worlds of science and religion. How dare they do that? And in reconciling that, they were turning their back on the Brethren. And remember, B.H. Roberts had just passed away, and so they were kind of feeling their oats down in Provo. So based on this, President Clark begins a careful audit of what's being taught in seminaries, institute, and BYU. He's the one that's going to sponsor the study. And they're going to interview a lot of people, and he's going through all the curriculum. And remember, he's coming out of the government, so this is going to be a very top-down, authoritative approach. What do we need to do here? And this is going to be like, you know what? It's time to clean house. And it's time to do it authoritatively with the full weight of the first presidency behind it. So this is the showdown at Aspen Grove, August 8, 1838. And I'm gonna show you this part, because I pulled this from the talk.
Should that not be 1938?
Details.
Yes, 1938. Okay, here's what he's going to quote to these guys. They're all there around the campfire and stuff, and he's going to say, "On more than one occasion, our church members have gone to other places for special training in particular times. They have had the training which was supposed to be supposedly the last word, the most modern view, the ne plus ultra of up-to-dateness." I'm going to flash a little Latin on them. "Then they brought it back and dosed it upon us without any thought as to whether we needed it or not. Before trying on the newest fangled ideas in any line of thought, education, or activity, or whatnot, experts should just stop and consider that however backward they think we are, and however backward we may actually be in some things, in other things we are far out in the lead, and therefore these new methods may be old if not worn out with us." Clark also warned that if unorthodox teaching continued, they would face the abandonment of seminaries and institute and the return of church colleges and academics. You may lose your institutes and seminaries if we don't get this thing turned around.
So it looks like the second bullet there, he's not saying that they need discernment.
No.
And just that's what they need.
They need us.
They need discernment.
They need to follow. What they need is to trust us. Okay, so. Okay. You're still fine. The charted course.
Back in, okay, so in 1938, how many people actually, how many institute and seminary teachers were there in the church? Was it 100, 200? It wasn't the thousands that we have today.
No, it was about 100. Right. When they had all the teachers and stuff like that. And in fact, he's going to quote in this talk, I don't know if I'm going to get to it. It's interesting. He's going to say in this talk, he's going to say, last year we spent, I think his figure is, $887,000 on BYU and seminary teachers, which represents 17% of the entire church budget.
I might do it. I was probably one of the last seminary teachers as a part-time, I was a college student. I was paid $600 a year to teach seminary.
We don't want mercenaries teaching our grandkids.
I was one of the mercenaries, but it's $600 a year. They paid the called seminary teachers in the wards.
I taught seminary, it was $600 a year. It was what was allowed without 1099.
Oh, you got that too?
Well, no, that's what the pay was, but most of the seminary teachers, including myself, never collected any of it. We didn't ask for it.
Well, I did. I was in college.
I wasn't supporting my family with that money.
Oh, believe me, there was a time just as I was, and we were in DeSoto at the time, where I actually took all the seminary stuff. I was getting ready to teach seminary, And congratulations, I was accepted to become a full-time seminary teacher. And I think I was offered, like, it was going to be like $28,000 a year.
Ouch.
And I went, oh, well, you know, well, our income's about to take, a dramatic drop, and we weren't able to do it. Because I was teaching release time, or I was teaching early morning seminary in my house. Okay, so anyway, so he's going to stand up here, and he's going to give them this talk, and part of the chart, of course, there's some things that jump out at this. And first, he's going to talk about, here's what we believe. You say, any individual who does not accept the fullness of the doctrines as to Jesus of Nazareth or the restoration of the gospel, the holy priesthood, is not a Latter-day Saint. Yeah, he's not messing around here. I've set these matters because they are the latitude and longitude of the actual location, position of this church. Knowing our true position, we can change our bearing if they need it. We can lay down our new course. As I've said, I'm going to say something about the youth of the church. And he says these kids are prepared to know the truth. These students are prepared to believe and understand these things are matters of faith, not to be explained or understood by any process of human reason.
Ouch.
In other words, trust us. Okay? And probably not by any experiment of any known physical science. These students, to put the matter shortly, are prepared to understand and believe there's a natural world and a spiritual world. The things of the natural world will not explain the things of the spirit world, and the things of the spirit world cannot be understood or comprehended by the things of the natural world. Okay? So it's time to lower the boom. So now he's going to say, now let me talk about teachers. So these kids are ready. Now teachers. No teacher who does not have a real testimony of the truth of the gospel as revealed to and believed by the Latter-day Saints, and a testimony of the sonship and messiahship or the divine mission of Joseph Smith, has any place in the church school system. If there be any such, and I hope and pray there are none, he should at once resign. If the commissioner knows of such, and he does not resign, the commissioner should request his resignation. the first presidency expect this pruning to be made.
Do you disagree with that?
No, no, that's what I say. So based on how you approach this, then you say, is that necessarily the wrong tact?
Yeah. Was that considered personal inspiration on his part?
Good question. Well, he's a member of the first presidency, so he would say yes. He would say this is scripture to you.
I don't see anything in there that requires inspiration.
No, but what he's, well, in fact, he's going to, listen to what he says next. This does not mean we would cast out such teachers from the church, not at all. We would take up with them a labor of love and all patience and long-suffering to win them to the knowledge which as God-fearing men and women they are entitled. But this does not mean that our church schools cannot be manned by unconverted, untestimonied teachers. Okay? Well,
we would say the same thing.
Yeah, we wouldn't disagree
very
much with this. And I think the struggle here was that this is exactly accurate. It was probably the way in which he did this that was a little tough, yeah.
Well, my understanding today at BYU, to be a teacher there, that you now need a temple recommend to teach there, but that hasn't been the case.
No, you watch this thing swing back and forth at BYU, and it does all the time.
Yeah, I had members as teachers at BYU.
Yeah,
but now...
So did I.
Yeah, but that's been in the last, 10 years, 5 years that they've changed it?
Yeah, there was a crackdown a little bit because there's always this balance about intellectual academic freedom at BYU versus top down. This struggle, this tension has never gone away. I was 10 years at BYU, and I saw this thing swing back and forth a number of times. But even then, they're trying to say, but for you as teachers, the mere possession of a testimony is not enough. They say, okay, you need to have a testimony. Here's where he goes next. You must have one of the rarest and most precious of all the many elements of human character, moral courage. For in the absence of moral courage to declare your testimony, it will reach the students only after such a delusion as will make it difficult. In other words, he's saying you've got to have the courage of your convictions. And what was happening for a lot of these teachers is that they may have believed it, but when they would go talk to professors of other universities, they were being ridiculed. Or in the interest of modernism, they were watering down what they were saying. There, by the way, I thought this was funny and kind of a little naive a bit on his part. For there is nothing the world so values and reveres as the man who, having righteous convictions, stands for them in any and all circumstances. There is nothing toward the world turns with more contempt than the man who, having righteous convictions, either slips from them or abandons them or repudiates them. These days, who's the most popular people in pop culture? Former Mormons. That conviction is, I finally saw that I was stupid and naive.
But they're claiming moral courage.
And they're claiming that's moral courage, is to recognize that Mormonism is a cult and we have now comfortably left it because we are enlightened. Okay, he was hoping that that was the case. And then I put on here, he's going to say, sham and pretext and evasion and hypocrisy have and can have no place in the church school system or the character building or spiritual growth of our youth. Anything other than that is going to be a sham. And again, he's not saying anything that is necessarily wrong here, right? We want teachers and need testimonies of our instructors.
So it goes back to one of your first slides there, traditional church or church that changes. And I'm not sure that he's struck a very good balance.
In fact, where he'll go with this ultimately is to say, if it's not in the scriptures and the prophets haven't declared it, don't teach it. So he's really going to go to more of an authority. The way to solve this is to double down on authority coming from the top.
Does BYU not have a pattern of publishing? So if they're a publishing school, a lot of publishing schools publish or perish for the staff.
Yeah,
would he have the same expectations of all our papers?
Not then. I mean, at this point, if you're gonna be publishing stuff that would be contrary to the brethren, you may not stay at BYU. because that will be, the, now.
How about critical of?
Critical what?
How about critical of the brethren?
Oh, no, that wouldn't stand either.
Okay.
It wouldn't stand today, would it?
Probably not.
No.
You're walking on
tender
ground if you do that, okay? All right.
Well, yeah. You know, as people, as individuals, there's a line we have to walk, you know, in the middle. I one of my friends is a old retired, he's older than I am by a number of years, believe it or not, but he taught at BYU for his whole career. And to talk to him is rather frustrating. He has an opinion on nothing.
Yeah.
You know, everything is well, you can, you know, he just kind of wobbles around. And he has been conditioned to never say anything outside of the box. And that's a danger too.
It is a danger.
Brother Eagley, what about like accreditation though? Were they not just accrediting?
Not much.
At that point?
No, and accreditation has been one of those things that is continuing to push the other side now, especially. But back then they didn't care.
Yeah, like our speech and pathology program at BYU is kind of in trouble right now because there's things that we don't want to make a part of our program that the licensing board is saying, well, you can't call yourself a speech pathologist unless you're well versed in this particular, you know, skill. So,
well, what I was trying to say is the tension is not all bad.
No, it's not. No, that's why I say the tension that we're talking about are the contraries. The pull to want to go to one way should be balanced by the pull to pull us back. And we're just going to say, I want to be loved, but I understand I need to be respected. I want to be respected, but love should pull me back towards.
Okay.
And how we do that is a struggle.
Were they teaching academics and avoiding teaching how to think?
A bit. Well, that was the fear. Hold on to that idea, because you're going. I'll show you the pushback. Let me say. Okay. And then finally, you know, something like this. Before an effort is made to inoculate us with new ideas, experts should kindly consider the methods used to spur community spirit or build religious activities among groups that are decadent and maybe dead to these things are quite applicable to us. Whether their effort to impose these on us is not rather crude, even gross anachronism. In other words, we feel like we're more enlightened. Let me finish with this. As far as the thing, and I'll show you the response. To get to, let's see, I say, you must teach the gospel. You have no other function and no other reasons for your presence in the church school system than to teach these principles. You do have an interest in matters purely cultural and in matters of purely secular knowledge, but I repeat for emphasis, your chief interest, your essential but all but sole duty is to teach the gospel as been revealed in these latter days. You are to teach this gospel using as your sources and authorities the standard works and the words of those whom God has called to lead his people in the last days. That's it. You are not, whether high or low, to intrude into your work, your particular philosophy, no matter what its source or how pleasing or rational it seems to be. To do so would be to have many different churches as we have seminaries, and that is chaos. You are not to change the doctrines of the church, okay?
That's not it.
You feel it? See the tension back and forth, okay?
That's the seed of our current correlation program.
That's where it is the genesis of the correlation program. This is where the seeds were starting to be planted, even though correlation didn't hit its stride until like the 60s. But this is where it's basically coming from. Okay. Let's see. Okay. So let me start give you a variety of responses then to this talk. This one you can sort of guess. Elder Joseph Fielding Smith. I've been hoping and praying for a long time of something of this kind to happen. I've talked to many of these teachers, including the Commissioner of Education himself, and realized thoroughly the need for such counsel and wisdom, which I hope will bear fruit. You know, we needed to call these guys out on what they're doing. President Clark responds, "I'm very grateful to you for your kind expressions about the talk. We have felt for some time, as you say we have felt, that something of this sort should be said, and we are trustful that now that it has been said, things will move in accordance with the ideas suggested." Okay.
So that was a talk, not a policy letter?
It was just a talk, yeah.
That thing that you...
The chart of course. And in fact, as early as, I think President Eyring, when he was commissioner of church education, he asked everybody to read the charted course before they hired on. Elder Holland, in some of his early talks, I was at BYU at the time, Elder Holland quoted a bit from this. The biggest proponent of the charted course was Boyd K. Packer. Boyd K. Packer quoted from it early and often and felt like it should be the standard by which church education people should look at this.
Well, there's been something like this has happened recently at BYU where it's been nailed?
Yeah, within the last couple of years, there's been an additional push because there are a lot of people outside the church, or outside Provo, members of the church that aren't happy with where BYU, the direction BYU is going. And they were starting to be a little bit more embracing of LGBT was one of those touch points. Okay. But Boyd K. Packer was really in favor of this. In fact, I still remember a shocking moment in sitting in high school. I was sitting in the back of a seminary class listening to the teacher, and the door was right behind me, and I heard the door open behind me, but I'm listening to the teacher, and I felt two hands on my shoulders. And I turned and looked like that, and I was looking down into the face of Boyd K. Packer. he's looking down at me, I'm looking up at him. And he was here to visit with the principal of our seminary, my teacher.
So, this 20 years ago, I was a primary president, and the Living Scriptures came out, and we had a whole thing about that is not to be used.
The Charted Course?
No, I'm saying in response to this push and pull, was it the Living Script? It was the videos. I don't know what they were.
Right, yes,
is it the Living Script?
The ones that the former missionaries were selling?
Yes, that was so anointing. They'd be like, here, give me the word list. We'll go door to door.
Yeah, we'll go door to door.
But we had a whole, as I would say, top down thing about this is not to be used in your primary class. We had one teacher that did. Anyway, it was a huge drama, and to me, I was saying, this person has been called to teach. If you don't want them to teach, then tell them not to teach, but let them do their job. And they're like, well, they can't do this, and I'm going, okay, well then release them, right? But that, still that push and pull, we only use this, you know, and this, it was 20 years ago, but yeah, it's recent memory to me.
It is. Okay.
And it's still going on.
Yes, it's still going on. I mean, I was surprised by it.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't get your doctrine out of some of these things, but even though their doctrine is imperfect, they're so sanctifying. So why would you turn your back on it? I just figured
if you're given a calling, you take care of it. We don't tell you how to do it.
We're going to have the same discussion. Trust me, in the next year or two on The Chosen.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember people getting up and bearing their testimony about the work and the glory.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then they would go visit Nauvoo and want to know where the
steeds were.
Where the steeds live.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, I didn't read that. I know how it is.
Here's a response from another general authority. I've appreciated more than I can express your observations concerning that speech, particularly your fine and sane estimate of the situation of the church school system and its needs. The talk at Aspen Grove is probably the first notice that I've had that I was feeling concerned about the situation, but I would like to assure you that concern is not newly born. It's ever been with me since I came into the presidency. Oh, this is Heber J. Grant. I hope we are on our way towards curing the situation that has developed. I said a good many things, his response, that I've been thinking for a long time, wishing to say I think that most of the parents of the church will agree with all that I said. Okay. One of the teacher's response, this was interesting. Sterling McMurrin, who would go on to teach at the church at Salt Lake Institute, who was always seen as kind of a firebrand and a bit of a leftist, he wrote, We divided ourselves up pretty quickly into liberal and conservative camps, and I landed among the liberals. There was considerable discussion about it around the campfires that night after the talk. So they're going to go to the talk, then they're going to go and sit around the campfires and discuss. Natalie and I were included in the campfire discussion presided over by Newell K. Young. That evening by the campfire, Newell got up and said, "I don't know about the rest of you, but before I go to bed, I'm going to go over to Lynn Binion and resign." He did, too. Brother Binion refused to accept the resignation.
Okay.
Tough cookies.
There were a number of resignations that happened after this. Okay. All right.
I would want to resign just because somebody was telling me what to do. Like,
here's Tucker.
You know, we had a similar situation to this when the essays were released. Yeah. I mean, some people were being accused of apostasy by teaching some of the principles that were taught in the essays, and it were released. I mean, it's not signed by anybody. It's fake. You know, I mean, we had a great deal of that happening. That was
even more than that in the 90s. Stephen Robinson, who wrote Believing Christ, which as a bishop, and even now, you know, when I've got people coming into my office that are maybe going through some kind of disciplinary council, we don't call it disciplinary council, and I'll say, "Did the bishop give you something to read?" "Well, yeah." "Was a certain book by President Kimball?" "Yeah." I'll say, tell you what, I will talk to the bishop, but I need you to read Believing Christ by Stephen Robertson rather than Miracle of Forgiveness. And I get the bishop to sign off on it.
So the essays, I'm sorry, that I don't know what
Gospel that means. Gospel topic
essays. Yeah, hold on, I'll get to those.
They didn't know who the essays are because they hid them.
I know.
And only the Tribune ever said that they existed.
Yeah, they're just kind of slowed up. Uh-huh. So again, with Stephen Robinson's book, when he started doing firesides on the Believing Christ, he had state presidents that would shut him down in the middle of a fireside.
Oh.
Because of what he was teaching in the Believing Christ, which is just standard for us now. The church essays, if you go to the church website, you're going to find the essays, and there are how many essays now?
Well, they just came out with 3 new ones, so I think we're up to 15 now.
Yeah, they're a lot on
Joseph Smith's Polygamy and Nauvoo, Heavenly Mother, Polygamy in Utah, the character of Joseph
the priesthood,
Smith.
So
how do you drill to it?
But go into the church.
Just Google it.
Gospel essays.
I don't know if it's considered an essay, but they have one on Book of Mormon.
An acronym.
Bloodlines
and all that.
There's one on the first. One on the first vision.
Race and the priesthood.
Race and the priesthood. And the interesting thing about these essays is that the authors are not listed.
Oh, they're really short. They have lots of footnotes.
Except for the one on Heavenly Mother.
Yeah, I actually taught that.
And the priesthood band.
I actually taught that. We did, in my institute class, we did Women in the Scriptures. And our very first lesson was the Gospel Topic Essay on Heavenly Mother.
Yeah, and it's out there. But it is interesting. If you start quoting some of that, you will get some pushback.
Are they authorized for, I mean, they must be correlated already.
They are.
They're totally correlated. They're written by faithful members of the church that are scholars in the field,
but not listed.
But we know Terrell Gibbons wrote the one about the character of God.
Yeah, that's one of them. And the one on race, I think was.
It was the University of Utah guy.
Yeah, it's good.
But they're never quoted in conference talks.
No,
they're never mentioned.
The substance of it is. But what you're not hearing in general conference is, let me quote from the priesthood from the church essay on.
Never.
No.
Like Elder Ruhlman referred to the Gospel Topic Essay on Heavenly Mothers by saying, "This is everything we know about her, and none of us know anything more."
Yeah. So. Right. So, but you're right. There is, as that information is out there, there will still be, on the other side of the church, people go, "Well, we don't necessarily believe that." Yeah, it's in the. I did on a trip. I have a returning mission president And I started quoting some of this, and he's going, well, we don't believe that. I said, yeah, go to the church essay. It's right there. And he's like, there's a church essay? Yeah, there's a church essay.
But those, I mean, like as a Sunday school teacher, we're not, Sunday school teachers are not allowed to go out of their curricula.
You can.
Authorized, or you just do it?
It's correlated. It's all correlated.
Yeah.
In fact, I never used the manual, but that was another story.
Yeah, isn't the reality that there's a large portion of the church that they don't go to church or to conference to hear the church essays? They don't want to hear them.
No,
right? Sure.
It's the devotional
side. Therefore, the rebels, like in this room, might be entering.
He was looking. You know, he looked at you. Not, it wasn't so much.
Anyway, for the, yeah, it's meant to be something to seek out.
Yeah, it is. And to me, that's the scholarship versus the devotional thing. And I think both need to be in the church, and we have people on both sides. But in our own lives, I think we need both. We need the devotional, inspirational side to get us through our daily stuff. But I think we also need that scholarship side so that we can understand the gospel better. And I think the essays, and I think, like you guys being here is a step that ups our scholarship game a bit.
But going back to the rising generation, seminary teachers today and institute teachers like us, we don't have the luxury of not knowing about that stuff because they are going to ask questions. And we have to, in fact, Elder Ballard gave us a charge in a CES devotional that said, the time has come when we don't answer with, I don't know, or your testimony. We need to be able to give them answers.
Well, and he says, and that day has passed, and frankly, we did not do a very good job at that.
Well, I mean, I think, I'm going to go right over it. I think it was wrong the way they were released. I read about them in the Tribune, just on a news.
Yeah.
The Deseret News never thought they were news. And the church buried them with obscure titles in the gospel topics thing. And then they eventually got some pushback on that, so much pushback, that they created a separate list of them in the library.
And to your point, I mean, it was gradually integrated, but to your point, I think even today, if you went on the church website, there isn't a link to the essays. I think you have to put a... Am I wrong? I think you have to go to the library and type in search.
Yeah,
but on the church website,
right.
I don't think.
And the obscure purification, I don't know, I'm saying that word wrong. That's not right. We have a right.
You think we kind of lazied into it a bit?
I just did not agree with that at all. I mean,
they're solid things that we should have heralded them, yeah.
I was going to say, so many times, authorized talks in the church treat us like children. Well, I mean, like,
if they're not careful,
right? And eventually, children grow up and move out, right?
To a certain extent, I understand because there are a lot of the church that is children. They are new converts in third world countries that need kind of a softer, gentler approach. And those of us that are more educated might, and sometimes Come Follow Me can be a little bit watered down if we're not able to use that as an impetus to study better.
But this man here did not know what the essays were.
So if you go to your library app, which most of you have on your phone, right? If you go under church history in the library, it is the very first category when you pull up church history.
There it is. It would be nice if the church essays were on the first page as a link.
You wouldn't think that it's church history.
Oh. Right. But why would it be under church history?
Well, like I say, on the search bar, if you'll just put church essays, they'll all drop.
So you mentioned, and I have felt this need for a softer, gentler approach for new members.
Yeah.
And not only for new members, but for all those members who leave after first hour and don't go to Sunday school. And I've tried to implement a class based on the Gospel Principles Manual, and it's not authorized, specifically not authorized by the general handbook, that we can't have a class on the Gospel Principles Manual. So I'm wondering, is there anything I can implement other than just whatever this year's Come Follow Me is?
That would be a good question of... I'd sit President Smith down and ask him. But I mean, Mike's pet peeve.
You can't take those that are gentle, that we need to treat gently, and lie to them, and then they find out they've been lied to, and they leave the church.
Sometimes the lie is simply, as a new member, as you were taking the missionary discussion, did you hear anything about Joseph Smith's polygamy?
No.
Did you hear anything about a priesthood racial ban?
No, but I kind of already knew about
that. That one you knew. What I've been advocating for is that those kind of things need to be taught while somebody's studying the gospel. They need to hear it from the missionaries, and they need to hear it with a spiritual discussion rather than hearing it after they Google it.
After they've been taught for a little while.
Yes.
As a matter of,
absolutely,
of disclosure, yes, more than...
But yeah. My understanding, did you take the new member lessons after you were baptized?
What do you mean by new member lessons?
Yeah. There you go.
There is a series of new member lessons that should be taught to somebody after they're baptized.
But they're not supposed to be taught during Sunday school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it has to be done at another time.
Well, I know. When you asked about the... What I had known about the blacks, and this was back in the 70s when I was younger, I'd always heard... that the Mormons didn't like black people, and they weren't allowed in the church or whatever. That's what I had heard, not specifically from Mormons, but just from what I heard in general.
Yeah.
But then, like you said about study, when I had the missionaries come and visit me, and we would do, you know, talks or whatever, I'd ask questions, and they'd give me answers, and they would refer to stuff in the Book of Mormon. But when I started going to church, the first day that I went to church, it was scripture study. And instead of going into the main chapel where everyone was doing scripture study, they had us. We went into the high council room, and there was just myself and a couple of other people, and the sisters were in there, and we were kind of going along with the chapters that we were supposed to have read.
Oh.
For that time, so I never, that's the only thing that I've ever had. No. I've never had any kind of...
That might have been.
We don't have a separate
manual. I guess I would kind of sum this up, guys, and I know we need to stop, but if you hear this tension that they were experiencing in the 30s is still with us. How do we teach the next generation, including converts, about the principles of the gospel, and you're going to get two competing, well, not competing, complementary contraries.
Contrasting.
Complementary would be great.
That wouldn't exactly fit. About how to approach it, and whether it's, and how we do it in all of our teaching is where the balance lies. And sometimes we do it well, and sometimes we don't do it well. We just don't. And so the struggle is, how do we get better at this? That's one of the reasons why I've so appreciated this class over the years, is that we have a chance in a different setting to discuss this stuff and do it in a faithful way at a time when it's not competing with anything else. That's why I don't like to go the same time as Come Follow Me, because that's a separate deal. But.
Well, the church is a repentance church. and when we change our thought process to get better, that is repentance.
It's metaneo, it's turnaround, yeah.
Well, and this really goes back to one of your first questions about how we handle it in our families. How do we teach? And
top down, bottom up?
Do we really believe in free agency? Because if we do, we have to accept the fact that our children may choose differently than what we've chosen.
It's true. How much agency do we want to give them?
Right.
Which all sounds weird, right?
All of it, except they're supposed to do what I tell them.
That's right. You've got agency as long as agency. We have downloaded to you the latest fix.
As long as you do what I say.
And now you have the latest app. So, all right. Wow, great discussion, guys. We'll see where we go next week. But I buried my testimony that the education of ourselves, those that we love around us, is the most critical part of the entire gospel. When Joseph Smith said, we are saved no faster than a man gains knowledge, we need to gain knowledge. How we gather that knowledge is going to be a challenge. But our ability to weigh both of these things about a testimony and understanding that sometimes we're not going to have the answers, and sometimes the approach in a gospel doctrine class or priesthood class or something might be heavy-handed, and we're having to maybe make our own decisions about what it is that we're hearing. And I think that's always going to be our challenge. I spoke at a Relief Society this last week, and we were talking about some of these things, and there were a lot of, and I tend to push the envelope just a little bit, and they were hearing things they hadn't really heard that I really believe in. So,
did you intentionally time this lesson the same week we are studying section 132?
No, I didn't, but I was thinking about it, because that one is coming next week, right? Is this next week?
Yeah. We're reading it this week.
Now let's talk about what we do with this little hummer at this point. Yeah, section 132 will be fun. Anyway, bearing my testimony, church is true. Thanks for being here. See you next week, and I leave that with you in Jesus' name. And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.